Good evening. My name is Chris Malcolm. I'm director of the John Curtin Gallery, for those of you who don't know me. I won't be talking much tonight. I'm going to be asking plenty of questions of both Pippa and Warwick. And we're going to allow you to ask as many questions as you like as well.
So it'll trigger us off, isn't it?
Yes. We actually did originally plan to start inside the gallery, but we had such a response to the invitation that we won't fit in the central gallery, so that's why we're sitting out here. So we've got to sort of change things up a little bit. We were going to go in and have a tour through and then come out here, but I've decided that you all look so comfortable that we'll start out here. And then if you want to, when we finish, when we've exhausted question and answer, we can wander through the space and have some sort of one-on 70 time with the artists in the space. Now I can see Pip, but I can't see Warwick. Oh, Warwick, is there? Okay. So if you'd like to come up and join me on the stage. Steffi's just at the back here. And while they're making their way up onto the stage, I'd just like to acknowledge the wonderful people of the Noongar Nation, whose country we're gathered on today, and pay my respects to the elders past and present. We've got a great deal of very positive feedback on the exhibition, which is wonderful. But I first had the idea for this show and started talking to both of them just a bit under 4 years ago, after the exhibition that you both showed in at Lawrence Wilson Here and Now, which is in 2014. And as most of you will know, we had the huge exhibition of Pippin's here in 2007, which was
amazing.
I think it was almost 10 years ago to the day when we opened the exhibition here.
I thought it was 11, actually.
Well, it is 11, yes. You're right.
My dementia's not quite there.
My dementia's better than yours. So, I mean, that show, we filled the space with 308 vessels, which I was panic-struck because we'd only put them in the space not long before we opened the show, and they were all incredibly fragile and sitting on tiny little bases.
And that was amazing.
It was a wonderful show too, but it was a terrifying experience for me, sort of worried that anybody touched anything, they're all going to fall over.
I was the only one that broke a vessel.
You were the only one that broke a vessel?
Baby one.
There you go. So I started talking to them about having an exhibition that kind of honoured their partnership and their collaboration, which I've learnt a lot about since that time, in the last 4 years. And it's one of those things that the more you learn about certain things, the less I feel like I know about it. So part of the reason of us all being here this evening is to extend that conversation about what the two of you mean to each other.
I think he wants to dump me.
And, well, I mean, I expect all of you have been through the exhibition, and as you know, it's in three rooms. Pip's in the Southern Gallery, Warwick's in the Northern Gallery, which, come to think about it, sort of represents the geography of where you live in Fremantle and Yanchep. And the Central Gallery is the kind of the meeting space, and as most of you will be aware, that the word confluence literally means a coming together. And it's usually refers to a coming together of waterways, of rivers, of equal size, which I thought was interesting. So there's this kind of hidden, there's some other hidden stuff within the title, which I haven't spoken to you about yet. Now, bringing the show together, I wanted to have a space in the middle of the gallery where we explored the collaboration. Not only the collaboration that you have with each other, but the other people who collaborate with you, and which includes Robert Frith, the photographer, who's worked with Pip for at least 20 years.
Many, many years.
Many, many years. And in many ways, Robert has been the conduit for Pip's work to be known beyond these shores, because when people are looking at your work online, they're obviously looking at images that Robert's taken. Mm-hmm. So Robert's played an increasing part in kind of organising visually your work, which I wanted to kind of explore a little bit. And there's obviously works of Robert's in the Central Gallery. And then a lot of the other material in the Central Gallery is probably more associated with Warwick's work and the people that Warwick's collaborated with, particularly for this exhibition. And notably, Matthew Bettinoglio, who's actually here tomorrow with you, talking. We're getting really good mileage. You've been here almost every day.
But he's done his due.
Absolutely. So if anyone's available tomorrow at 12:30, that's a public floor talk that Warwick and the filmmaker Matthew Bettinoli are going to do together. So as well as Matthew, there's also Ryan Burge, who created the sort of ambient sound field which is in the space, which, depending on when you're in there, you may notice it or may not notice it. But if you're in there for a while, you hear the cycle of the sort of field recordings of the ocean, etc. So I suppose I wanted to open up, and again, originally I was going to do this in the central gallery where we're standing in front of material, but I wanted to open it up with what you both remember of that moment when you first met. I know you encountered Warwick in action somewhere, and that was almost 30 years ago. You were telling me the other day, as Warwick as a...
He was barely 17.
As an 18-year-old or something. Now, as I was wondering what both of you remember of that initial encounter and how it got from that point to you working together, or Warwick working with you in the studio.
Well, do you want me to start first?
Sure.
Microphone up.
Yeah.
Well, I happen to have a wonderful Japanese potter called Patty Warashina, who'd come from Seattle, and she stayed with me, and Robert Bell had put on a big triangle at the art gallery. And she really wanted to meet Joan Campbell, so off we trotted down there one day, and while I was sitting at this wheel, it just blew me away. He was making these sort of 3-foot high jardiniers, just the clay was paper thin. And I thought, my God, this kid's got talent when it comes to throwing. He's quite unique. So I know that Joan was always terrified I was going to poach him, which, of course, I fully intended to. And so we'd have our little sticky cricket sticky minutes together on this issue. But, of course, very sadly, she wasn't well and finally passed away. And so, of course, I'm not sure. Did you come and help me before Joan passed away? I think you did.
Yeah, I think I did come maybe to work with you probably 2 years before Joan. Maybe three
that's
years before Joan passed away.
Yes, well, that's why she was a bit cross. But, of course, she wasn't in very good physical shape, so she didn't really, wasn't able to cope with that. But anyhow, I just knew the time that I saw Warwick and met him, that was the catalyst for me, because I just thought I had had a few different people helping me along the way, because I felt that I was getting a few degenerative discs, and sitting at the wheel was not my most exciting feeling anymore. So, of course, finally, he sweetly came, and he was wonderful. He was so dedicated, and he always wanted to make sure I was... He was great, and he was doing well, and he was wonderful. He was so humble in those days.
Okay, Warwick. So we've heard Pippin's first impression of you was you were the wunderkind, sort of making enormous paper thin vessels on the wheel. What was your first impression of Pippin?
Loud, I think.
Crazy.
Yeah, pretty crazy and very loud. I didn't know who Pippin was, and after Pippin left, Joan Campbell, that is, sort of said to me, don't worry about her. She'll go away, and because it was a pretty amazing time working with Joan down there as well, and working with on the beachfront. And when Pippin came down, she brought an artist with her, Patty Warashina, as she's mentioned, but those sort of things happened all the time. There was always people coming into that workshop from all over the world, because Joan was really well recognised, and it was fantastic for me as an 18-year-old starting out, really, to meet these incredible potters.
And how did you come to be working with Joan? How did that start?
I graduated from Perth Technical College in 1988, and Joan opened the exhibition of my graduate exhibition, and she saw my work at the show, and she really liked it, and she offered me a job.
And it's 10 bucks an hour she paid him.
But that's how I met her, and I worked with her for about probably a year and a half, maybe 18 months, working on some really big projects that went over Reef. They were big sculptural projects, fountains and lots of throne components in them. We did a lot of big murals for Perth as well, big ceramic murals. So it was a really incredible experience for me to be able to work on artistic work, ceramic throne work, because I was pretty much thought I was going to go into just making, you know, coffee cups and bowls and things like that when I came out of art school. But I ended up working as an art, really with on big, super, really big art projects and working with, you know, architects and other people who were artistic collaborators, you know, putting these things together. It was quite incredible, actually, at a young age to do that.
So in a way, it was kind of preparing you for a kind of a career where you're quite open to collaborating with other people, not only in other disciplines, but, you know, other ceramic artists or...
Yeah, it certainly was. And
apprentice.
Yeah, I was an apprentice, really, in a way. And like you mentioned, I did work with a lot of people in the workshop because it wasn't just myself in there. There was other people working in there as well. There was a couple of other helpers, and we all worked together as a team with Joan to pull off her visions, what she wanted to do. And she gave us a bit of time to make our own work as well, and we could sell our work in her gallery, which is now Kodogo, on the beachfront there. But when I was working there, there was a huge big shed on the side of Kodogo that was has now gone because it was asbestos and that pulled it down. But the actual stone building, which is Kodogo, that's still there, and that is that was our gallery where we sold work through there too.
Yeah. So when you started working with Pip, how did that actually start? Did you invite Warwick to come to the studio?
Well, yes, I guess going back to my early 3-year course at the Perth Tech, where I really had a passion for the vessel and the bowl, it went from there, and I always wanted to make beautiful vessels and bowls. So I guess Warwick and I, you know, we started working together, and he'd make the bowls, and then I would turn them all, but over time, he'd come and he'd look at my turning and say how atrocious it was, and there was a bloody big lump at the side or whatever, and why haven't you followed the curve and done all those things? So, of course, finally, I just gave up and I said, it's your baby, you know. And that's how it's been ever since, really. You know, he'll say to me, what do you want to make today? And I'll say, oh, I think we want to do some small pieces or we want to do some large pieces. And we have to plan because the porcelain that I use, or it's a combination of two very good porcelains, the preparation in the clay is phenomenal. So I have become a good pugger, putting gallons of porcelain through the pug mill 2 or 3 times. And then when I know Warwick's coming, we have to pull the logs out and get them harder, and then he pugs them 2 more times. So he knows the clay is in perfect shape. And, of course, we have it wrapped.
What's pug?
Oh, pug is a wonderful machine that... A wonderful man who sadly passed away recently, Jeff Hill. He invented the Venco label and the Venco pug mills and the wheels, and he also did all those amazing windmills as you drive down south everywhere and so forth. And he was a really amazing engineer, such a lovely, down-to-earth, beautiful man. And, you know, we got the first digital wheel from him, and we got one of the early pug mills, which still goes today. I mean, if you think about it, we've had both those things for 30 years or more, haven't we?
Those are people here who don't know what a pug mill does. What does a pug mill do?
Well, what a pug mill does is if you're using 2 different clays, or even if you're using the same clay, you actually have to blend them together, and you put it... You feed it into a thing and compress it, and it goes through a tunnel with blades. It goes round and round and round, and then it shoots out a lovely big 4 or 5 centimetre round log. And usually, a big, and it sort of de-airs the clay. So Warwick couldn't probably have worked with such large clay vessels unless we prepared the clay really well. That was really critical, wasn't it? And of course we'd have to bring in half a ton at a time, prepare it all, wrap it up in dry cleaning plastic for several months so it sweats, and then it all has to go through the pug mill again. I think when potters and people who are interested in working in clay, and unless they realise the time-consuming and how pedantic you've got to be about everything, the preparation of the clay, the preparation of the glazes, the preparation of colour, and it's all got to be put in a ball mill and milled all night, and everything has to go through fine 200 meshes of sieves, and there are so many facets to actually producing a beautiful object. You know, and of course Warwick's always had that beautiful sensitivity when he makes a vessel. I usually nurture them like my children for 6 days, and he'll come back the following week, and they're all at a special leather heart stage, and then he will turn them outside and inside and then refine the rim. And you know, there's a lot of work that goes into producing just a beautiful vessel.
That kind of leads me to a question I was going to ask a little bit later, but I'll ask it now, because I mean, when I've taken people through the exhibition in the last month and sort of on tours and explaining things, people are often asking me what. I mean, when I tell them that you've been working together for 26 years, they kind of look at me a little bit bewildered, and especially when I tell them that, you know, you've been working together at such a high level. And when I think about the thousands of hours of tedium and what I would think of as boring sort of tasks that you need to perform to get to that point where you have the beautiful object, what it is that motivates you both to continue to persevere when it must be the proportion of rather tedious task must be incredibly high compared to the moments when you're massaging the form into the you know, the final form, and you're doing the final sort of cut on it, etc., and or you're doing the glazing and you know, all that sort of thing. And I often describe that it's a kind of this pursuit of perfection.
That's the quality that Warwick always had in him. He always knew how to refine and finish the vessel beautifully. Of course, we always have to do fine sandpapering later once it's gone through the first firing. But he always had such a beautiful eye for form and shape, you know. And working with vessels, there are so many subtle variations of a vessel that's good, bad or ugly, you know, and he only ever made me beautiful vessels because he always understood the height ratio in relation to the diameter of the perimeter and so all sorts of little things. And it's funny, I think we both learn all the time from it, because sometimes it takes a long time to see. And you go, why has it taken me all this time to suddenly see? I mean, I could paddle on. I mean, Gwyn Hanson Piggott lived with me for 4 months and drove me crazy, but she was a very interesting character and a wonderful person to know. And I'd watch her making these vessels down at the Fremantle Arts Centre for a big show she had down there in those days. And her pedanticness and the way she threw, and she made me think about a vessel always. You don't want to look at a vessel and think it's got not going anywhere. Where do you stop the rim? It's got to have that balance, but it's got to all have so the sense of lifting up and the rim could go on. You know, throughout your life, in your career, you just come in contact with so many different people that give you such an insight to things.
Yeah, and for your work, I mean, I've seen the pictures, you know, over the years, working
diligently,
heroically, almost. Heroically. Yeah, I mean, you know, just I mean, the
throwing and the nodding of the head. And
yeah. But I mean, doing your own work at other times as well, where you're also applying a different kind of sense of perfection or pursuit of something that's sort of driving you to sort of, you know, refine the form and the surface, etc. But when you're working with Pip, what is it that really motivates you to kind of to keep on pushing? I mean, because you've both been working together for so long.
I know.
And, you know, this body of work that's in the gallery is, you know, is extraordinary.
And I think it's all about that gratification too, you know.
I think for myself, I've always enjoyed throwing pots. So that's been something I have enjoyed. And I guess that trying to find the different variations that I can, just little subtleties that I can see when I'm throwing between the height, as Pippin mentioned, to the width of a piece and the curve through it, and the way that I might sort of tuck the curve back under and just change subtle things. They're all things that inspire me to sort of look towards the next vessel and see where if I can just change things a little bit more. And it's just very subtle differences that I find challenging. And because they are so subtle, they look so simple. And the more simple they are, probably the harder they are to make in a funny way, to get that sort of real simplicity in the work that I think Pippin has been able to sort of demonstrate with her vessels. They are very pure and very simple, but you have to really, it's a real challenge to do that, to get it right. And that's what keeps me motivated to work. And I do really enjoy working with someone who, like Pippin, who has such an amazing eye for form, obviously, because she has, that's why she's employed me to do that. But an incredible palette and sense of colour, and how to put colours together, and how to basically break up the surface of these forms without really destroying the actual beauty of the form, to be able to make that type of surface work on very simple forms with, at times, really complex surface treatment that also can look very simple. And I think when you get those two things coming together, you get these really beautiful objects, and that's what makes me, inspires me to keep on working with Pip. And I really feel a sense of accomplishment and achievement, and I feel really proud when I know that this work goes all over the world to the best galleries in the world. And it gives me a buzz when I know that something that I've made with Pippin is sitting in one of the best galleries in Europe, and people are paying really quite big money for it. And
they're cheap here, I can tell you.
But no, it's a buzz for me, because it's given me that outlet to be creative at the highest level that I can be, which is, you know, world level, world class stuff.
Yeah. Yeah, because it's interesting. I mean, seeing the, I mean, the number of decisions you make, Warwick, you know, in determining the final form of the Devil's Marbles in particular.
Well, that's a really,
because I mean, I know, you know, you and Pip discuss the kind of general form, and, you know, some are taller, some are more squat, etc., and some have got more sort of hard edges and, you know, right angles or whatever. But seeing your work, I know that a lot of those decisions, and in fact, only the other day when I was in the space, I was starting to look at some of the forms, and they were reminding me of these forms. The two in particular, which I'll actually point out to you later, which you probably know the ones I'm talking about. So it's interesting that, you know, how much of you and the creative decisions that you're making with Pip's permission. I mean, you know, you understand each other so well.
We trust each other.
Yeah, we have great trust in each other, I have to say.
And I know, Pip, that you're there, but you're not there at every turn.
No,
you know, you're not standing over, looking over Warwick's shoulder.
Yes.
So it's that's the extraordinary thing, that, you know, it's the kind of understanding you have of each other. It's you know, it's really quite symbiotic, and, you know, where you know, they're your vessels, but Warwick is, you know, such a part of your vessels.
Oh, absolutely.
It's hard to describe.
A very pivotal role in my life and my friendship.
Well, it's as you said, we do have this sort of connection that we do trust each other, and with this Devil's Marbles series, I knew that we pushed the bowl forms that we'd been making for many years to, you know, quite an incredible heights and widths, and, you know, we really explored the form of the bowl inside and out. And I knew that Pippin was searching for something a little bit more sculptural, as she'd always sort of wanted to take it to a more sculptural feel with the groupings of the bowls that she'd been putting together, and these big sort of installations. And so we talked about it a little bit, and I think we just came up with this idea that we'd put these things together that were more asymmetrical and move quite away from that traditional sort of very symmetrical bowl. We went the other way and pushed them around and became much more sculptural and organic with the forms. And, you know, Pippin trusted me at times, I think.
I didn't have the courage to roll them. I thought they were going to split it open.
Well, they still can, but we lost a hell of a lot of work developing that body of work. I mean, Pippin, I said to her, when I said, look, I think we can do something like this, but you have to finance it, because it's going to cost, you know, a fair bit of money in porcelain and time for me to develop this. And you know, we did go through a lot of breakages and things destroyed.
Cracks.
Yeah, or lots of problems to get that body of work that you see. And I think I'd be exaggerating to say that it was probably 6 months of not really anything coming out to get that.
Did you do small ones and big ones? Did you do a group together, or was it just them?
I always like to work in small runs of similar sizes, similar weights of clay, and I'd get like a bit of a rhythm going, and I'd muck around with those forms. I'd push them out a bit wider and taller, and then I'd roll them and see what I could get from the different sort of proportions, all pretty much the same sort of scale. And then we'd sort of, after a period of time of doing, you know, different sizes each week, you could then start to put them together as groups, rather than like to say we're going to make that group and then just make them, boom, you know, and like that. It wasn't really like that. In a day working with Pip, I'd probably just make the one sort of size for that day.
There's always variation of form.
Yeah, but variation of shape in that size range. Yeah. But yes, that's how we put them together.
We usually worked one day a week, and he would make one day and then come back the next week, and then we'd roll them and turn them. And the thing that Warwick did also, he's a good teacher, Warwick, he's taught me a lot along the way, where we found that once if the marble didn't crack in the dry, we thought it had a 90% of survival rate. And so, of course, we'd have to wait for the marble to be bone dry, porcelain raw, and that would take a week or two. So it was quite a long process from making the original marble, getting it through, and then I've finally found a few wonderful people to help me, where we would spend, you know, you could spend up to an hour even on a fairly small marble, and we'd put them on sponges, and we were just using masses of different pot mitts and scrubbers. And that's what really brought the marble to life, was Warwick would start with all those little different indentations or planes, and the sanding back was amazing, because that's what gave it its energy, and then we'd fire it, and then, of course, then they'd be ready to glaze inside, and you had to wait another few days, and then clean it all off, and then you'd be ready to glaze the outside. So it took probably a good 4 or 5 weeks for each batch to go through all the processes before I could actually really work on them with my glaze and incising and layers.
So very, very laborious process.
Okay.
And like I say, there must be moments of heightened satisfaction. Sure, you love throwing, so just the act of throwing is a bit sort of satisfaction in some way. But to work for 6 months with no results.
Oh, we lost so many.
There were some testing times there.
But Warwick always found a solution in the end.
Yeah, I knew we could do it. I knew I could do it. We just kept on working through each problem, like very scientifically. I always said to people, just address one thing at a time, change one thing at a time. Otherwise, if you try too many things, you know, you're not quite sure what was it that worked, you know. So I always approach everything very scientifically, and by doing it that way, and thinking around, outside the box sometimes on some of the techniques we employ to get them to survive, we're able to produce that body of work, and which is the first time it's been shown in Western Australia.
Anywhere in Australia, man.
Yeah.
Oh, we did have.
So can you sort of tell us a little bit about the process once you start the glazing of the external surface, something the inside's glazed, and the multiple glaze. I mean, you've got those different effects.
Well, many, many different colours, and of course, you know, some days you go, oh my God, I don't know what to do or where to start. And I don't know. So, and of course, for 7 or 8 months, I was working pretty well 7 days a week. 6-7 hours, sometimes longer, a day, you know. I just became an absolute hermit at the time, and I was determined to produce enough. But it's funny, I've never been able to work where I've selected, you know, 9 or 7 or 11 marbles in different sizes and scales, looking at a sense of topography, and said, right, I'm going to work with this group and they're all going to sing together. I just tend to work weeks on end and produce X amount of pieces, and then the house is getting so full of marbles, and then I spend find my little friend up the road, Millie, who's become my little curator almost, and gardener, and everything rolled into one, and she would spend hours with me helping me look at it differently, because I was the maker of them. She had such a fresh eye. So we try to build groups and think, well, what's missing from this? And it just takes time. And then, of course, you have all the naming. You know, I seem to have a little team, you know, but another wonderful friend who's an academic as well, because I'm just a bimbo. I'm not an academic. I've never read a book from cover to cover, I think, except for Edmund de Waal's book on what's name?
The White Road.
What was it called?
The White Road? You read that one?
No, the first one, anyhow. I'm just blah blah. So you just take a journey, you know, and it takes its twists and turns. And I just noticed, even with the lustre work, you know, which I worked with lustre 11 years ago, or maybe 12 years ago. And last September, I've got two wonderful dealers in London, and Adrian Sassoon. I suddenly got all these lustres out and tried to think what I did and how I did it. And I had put away all this strange marbling fluid that you can't buy anymore. And amazing things happened with that. Anyhow, I got all the marbles I hated, and stuff, layers of gold, platinum, marbling fluid, and just went for it, you know, in the most excessive, because it's expensive, I think. You know, I've spent about 18 grand on lustres in the last 6 months or something. But I was taught by my father, you have to keep investing in yourself, and you mustn't be precious with materials, and just go for it and be extravagant, and that's what I am.
Excellent. So you can blame your father for that.
I don't blame my father, although he'd be so proud of his daughter.
So, Warwick, can we talk a little bit about, or can you talk a little bit about how that kind of perseverance and that belief that you can make it work was the platform that enabled you to create this
amazing
group of work,
brave.
Really enough, because for those of you here who don't know, Warwick approached brickmakers because, again, when we were talking about this a couple of years ago, Warwick's intention was to make the largest vessels that he physically could. He wasn't quite sure. He had some ideas about how he might do that, and he ended up finding a sort of industrial partner who had a kiln large enough that he could create these vessels in, and went out and convince them to, you know, partner with him on the kind of experiment. And 10 months or 10 and a half months later, here we are. But can you just talk through that process of, you know, when you first approached them and your own belief in you being able to make it work? Because I remember having a discussion with you when we were talking about, because we set the date for the exhibition was happening, and then Warwick needed to make the work. And we were discussing how few we could get by with, like what I could make an exhibition of. And I think I told him...
Five, you said once.
Well, we come down to three. I said, as long as he gives me three, we'll be fine. We ended up with 12. But it really was a process where, when you started, you didn't know how it was going to go. They didn't know how it was going to go.
You had a challenge, just like you wouldn't believe.
What's the biggest that you've done up to that moment?
Well, the biggest work I've done up to that point was still pretty large, but I'd made some large work with Joan Campbell when I was there. She had a pretty decent-sized kiln that I worked with there, but these pieces are substantially bigger than those. Yeah, so... But to... I guess to sort of illustrate how it all happened, it was your invitation after the Lawrence Wilson exhibition, which I made all that work for the Love for the Here and Now exhibition in 2004, and I had a residency at Perth Technical College, or I think it's called North Metropolitan College of TAFE. They gave me the space there to work and to use their kilns, and I did push those kilns to the biggest pieces I could make for that show. And after that, I guess the next step was I just wanted to go another step again, upscale it again, and I knew this space here, I knew what was possible here. I'm a graduate of Curtin, and you know, I spent a lot of time in this gallery when I was doing my undergraduate degree, because it had just only opened, and I could only ever dream that I actually might be sitting here right now with a body of work behind me. But I knew what was possible here, I knew there had to be big work. So it was, I guess, my vision to approach an industrial ceramic manufacturer. And in Australia, now we really only have brick manufacturers as industrials for industrial ceramics. All our ceramic manufacture on an industrial scale has gone offshore, porcelain and tiles and even roof tiles, unfortunately, in Western Australia are no longer being made here. But brick makers, they agreed to my proposal, which was to make 12 vessels, believe it or not, when I went and saw them in about September last year, so it was 12 months ago, and I put a proposal to them that I could have a facility to work in, and to be able to fire the work there as well, and to put it in this exhibition, and to make them as big as I possibly could. And they agreed, which was fantastic, because if I didn't, I didn't know where I was going to go, because that was really my lifeline, my only real chance to do this body of work was with a partner like Brickmakers. So it started officially in January, as far as coming on site, and I met Nathan and Ryan, Ryan's here tonight, and Ryan's the engineer kiln manager at Brickmakers, and he's the head geologist there and raw materials manager. I work very closely with both those two to produce this body of work, and there were other people there too, but particularly those two really were pivotal in the success of this body of work. But the whole company has been totally supportive of what I've done, and I honestly can say this would not be here without this body of work. Yeah, so.
Can you tell us a little bit about some of the challenges you had to overcome in that process?
You had to do a once firing.
Yeah, well, there are a lot of different.
Your first big pot fell off the bloody.
Yeah, there's a lot of challenges. For those of you here who are potters will know very well what I'm talking about. I'll try and explain it as simply as I can for people who haven't got a ceramic background, but making vessels, the traditional way of making vessels and the way that Pippin has made them is to actually, you know, throw them on a potter's wheel, biscuit, let them dry, biscuit fire them, so they get fired once, then you apply the glaze to them, and then you fire them again, and maybe even another time if you've got more glaze to put on them, they can be fired up to 3 times like that. But I wanted to work very much with the same process as that brickmakers used to make their bricks. I didn't want to have to change any of the production. I wasn't able. My proposal was not to interfere with their production. It was to put the work through at the same kiln temperatures, the same rates of firing as their bricks were being made, and that was to fire all these pieces once. So all the surface treatment, all the colours were all applied to the surface at what we call green or raw. And, you know, when you've got a vessel that's a piece that's, 200 kilos, which the biggest piece in there is, and you're applying, moisture back into the surface, it can rehydrate and crack or fall over, which I had those sorts of problems happen in the early days. And even, these things could come and bite you when you least expect it, even when you think you've got everything under control. So it was a very risky process to do, because the traditional way would have been just to fire them once, then apply the surfaces to them, then fire them again. But as only person in this room who really understands is Ryan, because he helped me load these things into the kiln. Just the process of getting them into the kiln was such a labour-intensive sort of
you had to make your own little space.
It was a lot of energy went into putting them in the kiln. The last thing I wanted to do was put them in 2 or 3 times each vessel, so I went for it the once off. And in a lot of ways, I think going forward for myself, I'll only work like this now going forward with once firing, because I was able to build surfaces on these works that I wouldn't have been able to build on them if I did it the traditional way. I was able to really layer the surfaces up and be able to create these really deep textures by, over a period of 2 weeks, each day applying more surface treatment to it, because I wasn't able to do it all at once, otherwise it would wet the piece up too much. So I'd have 3 or 4 pieces on the go at a time and be layering and building up the slips and glazes and overglazing, and by that process it created these incredible textures by layering these colours and these clay slips on top of each other. So, being working with in that space enabled that surface, the way I approached it, to actually happen.
Yeah.
That way it wouldn't have happened otherwise.
Yeah.
Mm.
So what you ended up with, how close is that to what you imagined? I mean, did you have objects that you imagined, back in December before you started?
It's a good question. I did have a vision in that I was going to make large vessels, and I wanted them to have a feeling that they were inspired by the coast, which I think I've been able to achieve. I wanted them to feel that they were expressive and alive, and really sort of, raw as well, and sort of gutsy work.
Visceral is a word I've used many times.
Visceral, yeah, it's a beautiful word. So that was my intent. And that picture of what they were going to actually look like, it wasn't firm in my mind. And my way of approaching it was just that I would spend the time at Brickmakers, and what I had at the end would be what would be at the end. And that was what I would show. And I'm just fortunate that it actually worked out very well, and I'm really happy with what I've got there. It blows me out that I actually got those pieces to that space.
Got them from...
I think it worked spectacularly well. And for everyone here, the last two came in just the week before the show opened.
Really only about 3 days before.
Yeah, I've got a 10.
I worked right up until the last minute with the work, and I had to always be mindful of the scheduling of the kiln at Brickmakers. There's 3 kilns actually, but 2 of them in operation, and Yeah, for a ceramicist or potters, this is an incredible thing to sort of hear. But the bricks are fired, made and fired so fast, you just can't believe it. I mean, the bricks come out of the pug mill, which is sort of the extruder, they call it. They're wet. And within about, they're fast wall bricks, within about 48 hours, they're fired and they're going out into the yard to go onto the back of a truck. So it's just an incredibly fast process.
How many bricks to a firing, you reckon?
Ryan can probably tell you that, but I mean, I think they there's about 700,000 units. A unit is a single brick. Some of the bricks are two bricks, so that's counted as two units. But so about 700,000 units come out of those kilns each week. So there's a lot of bricks going out into the yard, and hopefully more out into the marketplace than the layer currently is selling. But it's a very fast process, and I had to always be waiting for the kilns that would fire. The push rate of the kiln would be slower. I couldn't put my work through at that pace because it would just destroy it. So, which we learned, obviously. I suspected that from the start, but so the slowest firings are the firings that they make their solid bricks. And those firings are probably around about, they'd probably be in the kiln for a couple of days going through, and they're the ones that I had to put my work into, but those firings are rarer. They make a lot more of the fast wall bricks and the hollow core bricks and the solid bricks. So I was always talking with Ryan, making sure that I was on the pace for when the next push for that type of brick was, and that always coincided with my work being dry enough, ready to go in, and then when it was on, it would only be 3 days of that speed of kiln, and then it might be another 6 weeks before they'd do it again, maybe 2 months. So that's how it worked.
Can you, and I'll ask you to talk about the surfaces and the final kind of surfaces of your work in a minute, Pip, but Warwick, while you've kind of got a full head of steam up, can you tell us a little bit about the surfaces of your works? Because I mean, you know, when you look at that, and then you look at Matthew's videos, I mean, the resemblance is striking. Can you tell us a little bit about when you bumped into Matthew and how his work inspired what you ended up actually using on the surface?
Well, Matthew is a filmmaker. He's in Yanchep, and that's where I live too. And he's a keen surfer. And I was looking at his work online before I ever met him, believe it or not. Even though we both lived in Yanchep, we hadn't really crossed paths. And I saw his work on Instagram, and there were these beautiful drone shots of the Yanchep Lagoon, and I was saving them onto my computer, and that was my initial inspiration for the surfaces that I wanted to develop for the work. So I was, working with Nathan at Brickmakers and looking at the clays they had, and I was testing all their single clays that they were digging through the hills to see what colours they would produce just by themselves. And I was trying to get those beach cream colours, and then I was mixing glazes that I could get the turquoises to contrast with them. And anyway, I started to get some nice results. And probably around that same time, I happened to be out surfing at the Yanchep and got talking to this guy in the surf, and it was Matt. So, that's how we met, in the surf, at a little surf break there next to the Yanchep Lagoon. And I sort of said, look, I'm doing this show, and would you be prepared to maybe have a look at what I'm doing and maybe do a bit of documentation? Initially, it was just going to be a bit of documentation about the work, because I wanted to have something showing at the gallery that really demonstrated how incredible this brickworks was. And he agreed to come on board, and we met up, and before I knew it, he was out there with me at the brickworks. He had to do the safety induction. It took him half a day to do the induction and come on site. And then he came out there quite regularly and filmed a lot of the process, and then he started filming a lot of the beach stuff with me too, which I was casting a lot of the textures off the beach at the front of where I live. And you know, he was also documenting with his drone above the reef. That he loved to do that anyway. That was his personal joy to, you know, he's one of his own artistic pursuits to do that. And we just started talking about, wouldn't it be amazing if we could maybe project some of these images onto the work or into the space, or, and before we knew it, we were sort of putting these videos together. And then I started talking with yourself, obviously, and we were looking at ways we could show them, and we ran a lot of ideas past you. I know that you were instrumental in helping us set this way we've put them together. And I think it's been a real I'm really happy anyway. I can't quite find the right word, but it's just really added to my installation, I guess, to be able to put this body of work together with an audio visual side to it. And I really wanted to do something a bit different with ceramics that wasn't, for me, just the vessels. I wanted to make it a true sort of overall sensory experience. When people walked in, they'd be able to, you know, stand in awe at some of this imagery of the lagoon, of the ancient area there, and then look at some of the process that was involved and the contrast between processes of working with my hands and the machines at the factory, and then, you know, the connection that I have to, through my own love of the ocean and the beauty of that coastal region, coming right through to the work. So, and then even bringing the sound into the space, which I did with another artist, Ryan Burge, who came up and stayed at my house a couple of nights. And we went out on the nights that was very, very, there was no wind. It was beautiful and still, and it was just these lovely sounds of the ocean. He brought his microphones up and recorded from all different distances back from the ocean, right up inside. He was in the water with his mics, and he had them in a plastic bag and was putting them in the water. But he was coming back and standing further back and getting all these different sounds from different distances from the ocean. And then he said, I'm going to make this sound that's three-dimensional, so that when you walk into the space, you feel like it's a three-dimensional sound. And I think he's achieved that, because when I was setting up the exhibition and bringing the work in and the soundtrack was going, it just was quite incredible. I really felt relaxed and almost hypnotic in a way in there when I was setting the show up. And I think that's been another part of that I've really enjoyed, is bringing that audio, visual, electronic side through to the work, to a really traditional medium, and I've been able to explore some more contemporary mediums as well.
I think that's worked very successfully, and sometimes I've been in there with people and although they're hearing the sound, they don't notice it, and then you point it out and they go, oh, of course.
Yeah.
But when you're in there and you turn the sound off, the space is very, very different.
Mm.
So
yeah,
it's,
the sound is normal, but then there's too many people.
Yeah. So Pip, so Warwick's works sort of visually are inspired by the coast. You love surfing on the coast just outside your home in Nanchet. But Pip, your works for many, many years have kind of referenced the interior landscapes of the continent, and have referenced key times that you spent long time ago up in the northwest that kind of really, from my understanding, kind of alerted you to the grandeur and the variety and the...
It was only 25 years ago.
Only 25 years ago, okay.
Yeah. That's nice.
After you met this fellow.
Yeah, I went on that.
But can you talk us through a little bit about how you create those... we see how you create those surfaces, but...
Well, they've been through quite a different transition. You know, I've always loved line work.
Yeah.
I think 25 years ago I got the Australia Council Fellowship or something, and I had heard about this woman, Helen, who was a pilot and was running people around all over
the Kimberley and through the Tanami and up to Melville Island and Yuendamu and where? The Bungles and Pargo and all in that area, and she was doing these trips, so I decided that I'd spend $10,000, I think the cost of the $25,000 whatever I got from the Western Australian government, and I went on this trip with four or five other people, and I have to say, I think I was about 50 years old, I'm now 75, so it must be 25 years ago. It's just the same song going. But it was amazing. It humbled me greatly because I felt terrible that I'd, you know, I suppose through all my schooling and academic, and it was never my thing, you know, we never really learnt about our culture and the Indigenous people, and we were very ignorant, really, you know, and I think that trip opened my eyes and humbled me so much, because we went out to all these wonderful communities and Helen knew how to approach them. She used to be a nurse with a flying doctor, so she knew how to make sure that we could go to the community and be welcomed and so forth. And we did do this amazing trip. We all met in Alice Springs and went out on this small plane. It was 7 days of incredibleness, really, and we stayed at Yuendamu, and we camped at Barbo, and we'd spend hours. These other people that I went with, there was a Sydney guy who really loved wanting to collect paintings, and there was an American girl who wanted to buy paintings, and there was a French woman from the embassy in Canberra wanting to buy paintings, and there was me. And I had no intention of buying paintings, but anyhow, I did get swept up in a thing of things and ran my credit card to the Hilt and bought $10,000 worth of paintings and sold one some years later for $45,000 to the Newcastle Art Gallery. So I made my money back, which was sad to sell it, but anyhow. But anyhow, it was an amazing trip, and I'm not one to take lots of photographs or draw or write notes. Everything I've ever done with journeys, whether it's to Pakistan or the Hindu Kush or to the heart of Australia, I just absorbed emotionally and physically, and I absorbed colours and the sky and the horizons and all those things. Just somehow I get absorbed. But it's interesting, you take a journey and then it really takes time for the journey to come out the way you want it, because you don't want to be sort of very, well, I sort of wanted to move away from the very painterly quality that I was doing at the time, and I wanted to move into a sense of timelessness, and I guess that's where the Tanami traces started to evolve. I figured out a technical process that enabled me to develop all these fine lines and so forth and so on, and it took a long time, just as every new technique or new form, new whatever it takes, but I have to say that for so long I've been very engaged with just the pure form and the pure vessel and the constant excitement of taking risk and developing so many different colours that, you know, one day you've got half a cup of something fabulous and then that's gone and you don't know how to get that back. But you just constantly fuse and do layers, and then you incise, and then you fill all these lines. It takes, you know, anything from 3 to 7 or 8 hours to do a vessel, depending on the size, depending on your mood, depending how confident you're feeling that day, and so forth and so on. Mm. So I think that the incising, the line work, has become my sense of... as what Warwick's become his sense of form, the surface is, that's definitely become my signature in a funny kind of way. And I know that when I was invited to do this huge 6-meter exhibition for the Henan Museum in China, which is the largest cultural museum in central China, and I rang her and she said, well, we want 6 meters and you'll have your own vitrine. And I thought, what's a vitrine? I'm so dumb, you know. Anyhow, and of course, moving into the marble thing, was quite exciting, really, and it was only because Warwick had the courage, you know, and the determination to help me exercise something a bit organic, which I've never been able to do. So, and then to have this show to work towards, it's been amazing because it made me, I know when I came back from the States in January, I thought, oh, am I going to commit to the marbles? Am I going to, you know, because you have days when you feel like you're going crazy and you just can't do anything. It's very hard because you're all the time pushing yourself. You're never happy with that. You just want to find another nuance all the time. That's what drives me crazy, you know, is always looking for the nuance, whether it be colour or form or some expression I just can't express and think about it all now. But anyhow, I think that this has been the most wonderful experience for myself and for both of us to have a show of this nature. I felt that I was getting old. Warwick has played a very pivotal part of my practice. I love him to bits. I get cross with him sometimes, but not very often. And he gets very cross with me sometimes. But at the same time, I love him dearly, and he has been so important, and he's kept me going all these years because he's been able to produce beautiful canvases for me to work on, and I thank you for that forever and ever. Any questions at any time? Yeah. Sorry to interrupt.
On that note, there must be lots of questions in the audience. Sam, are we going to... Oh.
Right.
It sounds good, like the bell.
That was a bell.
Oh, it must be time to get up.
It must be time to get up. Well, if we can take a few questions...
Yes,
Sam,
do you want to take this mic?
No. Okay.
Take that one. Well, we can share this one.
Yes, good.
Yeah.
Okay.
Thank you.
And then you can... Okay.
There's a question here, Sam.
There's a question just here.
Hi, I've been following your story as far, and I realised that there's a lot of...
Is she talking to you or me?
I noticed that from an 18-year-old at Petty University and then meeting beginning, and your journey thus far with exhibitions in Europe and renowned places, I'm very interested to find out from you, how did your journey, like how did your mind shift happen from a student to wanting to go further and higher and greater heights? How did the mind shift happen? You can describe that in a few words. Thank you.
Okay.
I've been a student in two sort of chapters or periods of my life. I was a student obviously at high school and then primary school, high school, and then I went straight from there into Perth, what's called Perth Technical College, and did a 3-year diploma of studio ceramics. And funnily enough, Pippin had done the same course about probably 8 years before I got there. And then I was also a student, as a mature age student, I went to Curtin when I was about 30. And did a fine art degree.
Isn't amazing?
Yeah, and Pippin did the same thing. She went to Curtin as well. So before I did, so Pippin was ahead of me coming. But we both went through the same institutions. But I always had a belief. I don't know what it was when I was. I think it was when I was at Perth Technical College. I had that belief that I could do something special with clay and. I didn't imagine myself doing anything else, and I worked professionally. I worked professionally as a potter up until I was about 34, 35. That's when I went into school teaching. But I always imagined I was going to be a potter. But I guess to do a show like this, I only dreamt that I could do something like this. But I always knew I had it in me, and this was the opportunity to really bring it out. So it had been in me for a long time, and I got a little bit of a taste of it when I did the Lawrence Wilson exhibition, and then to the opportunity here, I knew that it was that was the real deal, and I was going to have to put myself up on the pedestal and bring out all this into the world and show up to everybody. But I always had a belief that I could do it, so from an early age. I don't know if that's answered your question or not, but...
I had someone ask that, you always have a belief that then you conceive something and then you achieve it. Do you feel like... You have this belief.
Mm.
Do you feel like there's a spark of vision that makes you... I can do more than that?
I don't know. I mean, it's just in my nature to, if I'm given a challenge, I'll always try and work my way.
You've always been so engaged in throwing clay from a young age, you know, and you worked for so many potters, through for this one, through for that, ran. That's what he survived on for years, until he eventually took the plunge into teaching. But, I mean, from the age of Dot, he was roaming around Australia working in potteries. When he was here, he was working for potters. We're all fighting over him, saying, you promised us 2 days last week, and now you work for her, you know. And, you know, that was his thing for a long, long time, apart from his mad surfing and his beautiful daughter, who's a great surfer, too. So, have we... Set off the alarm.
Just don't. There's nothing to worry about. Just the door.
It's all good.
No, I put my smoke out a while ago.
All right. Question at the back.
Yes. Well, I wonder if you could comment briefly on the philosophy behind the scale of your work. You know, I imagine that most people in the room are like, "You've never seen pots that big outside of a book or a YouTube video." You know, where does this stop? How? What's the driving force behind this? And is it true that bigger is better? If we just keep getting bigger, I mean, where does it end?
No, bigger is not necessarily better. It's just his thing.
I guess it for me, it was a challenge to do something like this. And look, you know, from you know, you only look at history books and you can see big vessels right the way back, you know.
But not 200 kilos.
Well, there have been some very big vessels made over the years. I mean, there really are some large pots across, you know, in world ceramics. And
so you get them past.
Yeah, well, there are some big vessels out there, Pip. I'm telling you, I've seen them, and they're...
over the border.
Yeah, well... But... Look, I mean, I've always been fascinated by that scale, and I guess the philosophy behind it is that I wanted to create work that, you know, had a real physical presence in a space, and that you could walk up to it, and it had a sort of a life-size scale that really confronted you in a sense, and it was sitting on the floor, and it had that sort of power. Have that real presence in front of you. I'm not coming up for the word here, but...
If I can just jump in there, I mean, by contrast, the two smaller vessels of Warwick's that are in the Central Gallery, which were like maquettes or sort of experiments, I mean, they're large vessels in their own right, but they don't have that physical, you know, they're not something that you can walk up to and feel confronted by, like the larger vessels do. So,
mind you, he only went 1.6 because the kiln had a tunnel.
Well, no, it was just the height of the kiln, but, I mean...
Would have gone bigger.
Yeah, I mean, that's big enough, though, that piece. I mean, I don't have any real ambition to build pieces bigger than that, put it that way. You know, if I would have had the opportunity of brickmakers, if I look at a bit more height, I probably would have. But look, that was the biggest piece I could make with the kilns that I had available to me there at Brickmakers, the biggest piece in the show, Meridian, and it was a challenge to get that piece out, I can be honest with you, because I lost one that big, that didn't get anywhere near the kiln, actually. It fell over in the studio when I was putting the slip on it, and I was just fortunate that I wasn't underneath it when it fell. Because it would have been like two All Blacks landing on top of me, you know.
Two All Blacks.
It was memorable enough, let alone landing on
me. Like sumo wrestlers.
Yeah, there's another couple of questions.
There's a question just over here.
Okay.
Yeah,
Tell me, please, about the title Confluence. It's such an elaborate but so fitting word. How did it come to fruition, I guess?
Well, I'll answer to my knowledge, but Chris will definitely, I'm sure, chirp in here because it was his title. But
Chris has been the mastermind.
You know what? I'm going to let Chris answer that question because I think it's, he did actually conjure that name, and I'll let him answer that. I think he'll do it justice.
Well, it was, I mean, the idea was to, I mean, like I said earlier, we'd shown Pippin's work 11 years ago, and I wanted to equally show their work. I mean, people have been aware of Warwick's participation in Pip's practice for many, many years. And, you know, Pip has always acknowledged how critical Warwick's own kind of participation in her practice is to the success of her work. But I wanted to sort of both celebrate that, but also be able to show, you know, people what Warwick does himself. So, I mean, this exhibition was the challenge, really, for Warwick to build that body of work. And, I mean, as I mentioned at the very outset, I mean, the word confluence to me was really a coming together of two equal forces. It wasn't, you know, it's not saying that Warwick is a lesser player in the relationship or the collaboration, that both Pip and Warwick need each other to kind of to have been able to do this
and
work.
Tell them that you and I are all going to live for another 10 years.
Yes, and we've already booked in another exhibition in we won't live in 11, we'll do it in 10.
Okay? In 10, yeah, I yeah.
In 2028, I'll be... How old are you?
I'll be
85.
And Chris will be
66. I'll be retired. It'll be my retirement show.
Yes, it'll be your retirement. It'll be my swan song.
And what about you, Warren? Will you be around?
It'll be his speed bump.
I intend to be around. I hope I'm around.
You won't even be 60.
No, that's right. So, I'll be the young buck still, hopefully.
So confidence is just sort of coming together of these two forces. And I agonised for months over what I was going to call it, and that word just sort of come to me, and it just sort of stuck. And
I think from when you first told me the title, I looked it up, and it did say, you know, the two rivers coming together of equal width,
yep,
to make you know, one, yep, to be one, yeah. So yeah, or something like that. It's a beautiful word, and I really like it.
It is
and,
a nice word.
It is. It does really fit. I think the definition does fit what we've done and our relationship. So cool. Thank you. Thank you for that title.
Thank you.
Thank you for the question.
Another character in the piece is definitely Wessex Grand Landscape, and I know Pippin is headed now to see her son in the dead of winter in Minnesota, yeah, which is another iconic ceramics landscape with Warren McKenzie and Claire Illions around there, a very different kind of ceramics. But I'm just wondering, Pippin, if you going there again in the dead of winter where it's mud and ice and snow.
Not much mud, it's just...
If you'll ever be inspired by that kind of a landscape to make another kind of work.
Well, I have been inspired by it. I was inspired by that landscape, and this brings me back to when I was in Pakistan, which is a big difference from Minnesota on my side. But when I was in Pakistan, I drove up in a jeep in Kalash, which was right up on the border of Afghanistan and Pakistan. And we went right up through the valley in the mountains, and it was amazing. There was still snow on the ground, and there were a few of the most magnificent old fir trees, like the Douglas fir trees. I can't think what they were called, what their botanical name was. And there was just snow weeping on these amazing trees. And I remember I did a very beautiful piece when I did this show, and I called it Kole Nida, which meant the song of the mountain. And the art gallery, I mean the National Gallery in Canberra, bought it for their collection. So I do love all the time, the sense of snow and white and the beautiful pine trees and all the rest of it. But it's a bit like the contrast of going to India for the last 18 years with the crows and the millions of coconut palms and so forth and so on. And it's all lush and green and monsoonal, whereas... So both those landscapes, interesting. I've never really been able to transfer that emotion into my work, really. Yeah. But thanks for the question. That's good. I was wanting to find out that number of your cousin or aunt in Minnesota that you told me about. Huh?
The mother.
Your mother, that's right. You can't go without giving it to me. I'm going there on the 12th.
Well, on a practical situation, having moved one of your pots, what was the logistics in moving all that lot?
Oh.
Very carefully. That's the short answer.
One at a time?
Yeah, one at a time. I mean, they were all moved by forklift. That was, an awesome part of the on pallets. That was an awesome part of Brickmakers, was the fact that, there's that many forklifts there running around. And I got to know the forklift drivers really well, and Ryan as well, who's pretty handy, very handy actually on a forklift. And so they were moved on forklifts. To get them here, Vince, who's the managing director of Brickmakers, said to me, "Oh, look, have you thought about how you're going to get them to the gallery?" And I said, "Oh, I'm not sure yet." And he goes, "Well, look, I'll get one of the BGC trucks here, and we'll put them all on the truck and take them out in one hit." And I said, "Oh, I don't know about that, Vince. It's like a year's work on that one truck, and..." Yeah, if anything goes wrong, it's going to be a serious disaster for me. So I did use a Brickmaker's vehicle, but it was just a ute, and I moved them all here one at a time. And so I just forklifted them, and I got them on the back of the ute via a forklift, strapped them down really well, found a really good way of strapping them using slings and pulling them down to the pallet. And then brought them here, and underneath the gallery here's a loading dock with a overhead sort of gantry style crane that we could just sling under the pallet, pick it up off the ute, and then it just just manoeuvred it back onto the dock and then onto a pallet trolley and up through the lift and into here. But one at a time, and there was 12 that I moved here. It was certainly, I got a few looks going down the Leech Highway with these vessels strapped on the back of the ute. And it was sort of simple, but my heart was in my mouth and my eyes were on the rear vision mirror all the time, making sure that people behind me could see my brake lights when I was coming to a stop. Yeah, so, yeah. Did I hope that answers the question. Yeah, yeah.
Just one minute. Well, I just wanted to ask you about shrinkage rates.
Oh, yeah.
Of your pots, like once five compared to twice or three times five.
Well, look, the shrinkage rates of, for those of you who aren't potters, clay has moisture, water in it, and as it dries, the water evaporates out, and ultimately, once it goes into the kiln, it's chemically taken out of the clay. And turns clay into ceramic, and that process, the work shrinks. So the pieces were quite a bit bigger before they went into the kiln. But the clay that I'm working with, the Brickmaker's clay, has a very low shrinkage rate. It's got a lot of non-plastic material in it, and the more plastic material, which is your kaolins and your clay, your real clay, that's what shrinks. The more non-plastic material that you have, the less shrinkage you have. And with bricks, the shrinkage is an enemy for making bricks, because shrinkage produces cracks. So the clay that is formulated for the brick production has a very low shrinkage rate. And I also use the clay at quite a hard consistency as well, so it had less moisture in it than possibly most potters would use. And I had all the clay was processed through my own puck mill that I modified a little bit to extrude the clay into big coils that were quite firm, and I was able to then manipulate them. I worked the clay as firm as I possibly could so that I created less shrinkage. But the slips that were all applied to the surfaces were very wet, and there is obviously differences between the wet slip, even though it's the same clay body, on the surface of the drier clay, you do get differences in shrinkage. And if you look at the work, you can see there's lots of like tiny little sort of like just surface cracks, which is all part of the texture, and that's that shrinkage between the surface slip and the clay body just being a little bit more on the surface. And it's like a mud crack, really, on a salt lake, in a sense. That's a really good example of clay shrinking, you know, when it dries out, you know, on a mud flat and or a salt pan, and you get those beautiful big cracks. That's the shrinkage factor happening. But it was minimal, but I did use the process of shrinkage to create some of the texture as well. Hope that answers your question. Yes, one more back, I think. Yeah.
What percentage?
Percentage of shrinkage. I think that brickmakers work around about 6%, but it could be bang on. Ryan's got his hand up, he'll be able to tell us, right? 5%. 5% shrinkage. And for a potter's clay, shrinkage is around about 10 to 12, and for a porcelain with pippins using, you're looking about 14. So it's a lot less, hell of a lot less, yeah, shrinkage than a conventional clay.
Hi, Laura.
Ah, hi, Dee.
Were you able to change any of the atmospheres in the kilns to either reducing or oxidising atmosphere?
This is a real potter's question, and you are sitting in the same line there as I think pretty much Ryan, who is the man at the control centre. And yes, to answer the question, the kilns are all gas fired at Brickmakers. Ryan, feel free to chip in any time here, because you are the man of the moment here. But they're all gas fired. All the kilns, obviously, all the burners produce combusting, and you know, it's a mixture of air and gas. So you always, brickmakers are trying to get the most neutral atmosphere they possibly can for the most efficient burn on the kiln, which is slightly oxidized, maybe a little bit of reduction, but trying to play on a neutral spectrum, I would say, to get the best efficiency out of the kiln. So that's the majority of the bricks being made there are being fired in a very neutral atmosphere. However, there are a range of bricks there that they do put a lot more gas into the kiln to bring out the iron and what we call as potters a reduction atmosphere. Brickmakers call it a flash, where they flash the kiln with a lot more gas in it. And I was fortunate enough to get my work in some of those kilns. And the work that you see in the gallery that has a much warmer quality, it's a much more orangey sort of brown, orange, much more toasty look to it. Those are the pieces that went into the flash or the reduction firing kilns at Brickmakers. Yeah. But it's rare to do it, but it's awesome when they do it, because when you look into the kiln, there's these huge, big, basically tunnels of swirling flame, and you can actually see them moving between the bricks. It's quite special, really. Yeah. Okay. Any more questions?
Oh.
One here. Yeah.
What happens to all the works up to this exhibition?
He sold them all.
I'm very lucky. I have to deliver them to.
Is that a sellout?
Yeah, I have to deliver them to people who have purchased them, which is really nice for me. So it's been successful. I actually do have three pieces that aren't sold, but all the rest have sold, yeah. So
all local or international?
All local.
I believe they're all local. I didn't deal with the sales of the work. I contracted an agent to do it for me, but
Sculpture by the Sea.
Yeah, the Sculpture by the Sea have been the selling agents for both Pippin and my work. So, yeah.
And yours,
a number have, but nothing like Warwick's, no. People think it's too expensive and they can't believe it's half price in Australia. That's fine, that's it. That's fine, I'm going to have a rest for you. Yes,
we're having, a rest next year. Pip and I are having a rest, aren't we?
No, no, we're not. I'm going to make lovely vessels again next year. No.
Oh,
which is a pity they couldn't travel, but
yeah,
it would have been all very difficult to arrange a touring show.
Some are travelling,
huh? Oh, yes, they are. There are five major groups there that are going to London when I come back from the States, yeah. I'll probably be doing something in Boston as well in April. So in some ways I'm glad people haven't bought too many, because I really can't. I'd like to sort of work in a much calmer way next year, and I'd like to use the marbles that I have available to then build some beautiful vessel forms, like I did with the closed forms, the bungle bungle forms, and the vessels before. And I'd like to now come back with vessel and rock as small groups. I think that Warwick and I were thinking about developing a slightly looser form, but I think in a way I've had thought about it that because the marble's so organic, if you find the right marble to sit with a vessel, it looks quite beautiful. So that's my direction next year. So it'll be easy for you, darling.
That's quite exciting. You've got a new idea, but not being totally exhausted after this.
No, this year has been really intense. We've both worked exceptionally hard, and of course Warwick's had to rush down to me one day a week, mostly. Yeah, we've just both been really full on, you know, and I'm off to India to starve for 2 weeks on Sunday and have 4 hours treatment every day and detox and regain my strength back again. I've done it for 18 years.
I mean, I just want to take this opportunity to thank you both for committing to this exhibition and having such a busy, crazy year to
always a great
to make the
wonderful for us
for the show, and I'm serious about 2028.
Oh yeah, I'm serious too. I want to just hang in there even if I really have a thing.
Special thank you to you for curating it.
Yeah.
It is one of the most excitingly creative exhibition for.
It's very
easy
to do.
He stays quiet and soft and sweet, and suddenly he just out of the abyss comes these beautiful ideas, and then of course he's also got a beautiful team that help exercise all these beautiful visions. And he did the same for me 11 years ago, and I just feel so privileged and lucky. In fact, I just know I was born under a lucky star.
I mean, it is all about teamwork. I mean, you guys, you know, make a fantastic team, and the team here at the gallery really made my vision to the time.
And don't forget Paddy. Paddy. Where's my Paddy?
Paddy got the last question. You said you had a question.
Well, I had a question that I think was good from one of the gallery attendants for Warwick, because we see the exhibition while it's been on from the CCTV a lot, and it's a different angle. And someone asked, is there something significant about the layout of your exhibition, Warwick, the way the works are laid out in a circular pattern? Because you don't necessarily see the circular pattern when you walk in at the same level of the works, but we see it on the CCTV, and whether that reflects the individual works themselves, and is that what
awesome considered when
preparing the layout?
Yeah, it's a good question, actually, because it is an installation of work, and it was very important to me how I set that out. And the title of the show is Meridian Arc, and I wanted to have an arc which it is. An arc is like a central point with a radius off it. So I set it up like that, and it all comes back to the actual whole circular motion of a vessel for me on a potter's wheel. And it sort of tied that together, I guess, abstractly with my notion, also the way I've actually been able to apply the surfaces to the work, which was also with an arcing motion of my arm with huge amounts of slip going up the work. And so it just seemed fitting to me to actually have it set out like a sweeping arc, the body of work. And I sort of also set it so that you got the smaller ones on the right as you walk in, sort of coming up, the arc also moving in an upward spiral motion when you walk in as well. So that's and the whole a feeling, I guess, of that Fibonacci sort of curve as well, a little bit with that, you know, in symmetry and spiral in nature as well. That sort of is also been in my mind as well as part of that installation as well. So there's a few things going on, but it's all around. That's the sort of the vibe. The vibe.
It gives off an amazing vibe because if I can just share for 2 seconds with the group, we had a visiting group from Zimbabwe who were going to the Hive, which is a visualisation room in the next behind this wall here. And they had 10 minutes to kill and they went into the exhibition and I followed them in maybe 5 minutes after they'd gone in, not knowing how they would be in an exhibition space, and walked in to find at least half a dozen of them hugging Warwick's work. To kind of like gather them together to sort of say, well, we don't usually allow people to touch. I said, be very gentle with Warwick's, but I have to make a promise you're not allowed to hug Pip's work. So I took them to Pip's work and I loved it, and their enthusiasm for the creativity that was there. The one gentleman came out and he was running late for the tour, but he didn't care in the other room. But he came out and said, I want to put that creativity into my blood. How do I do that? to Zimbabwe, which I haven't told you yet. It was really interesting to see and exciting to see, even though I was shocked when I first found the weeks. I knew how heavy they were.
Yeah.
That was gorgeous.
Thank you.
Well, on that note, if you could all join me in thanking Pip and Warwick for sharing.